Hello, fellow readers. I'm Fasti Collins. In today's episode, we are featuring two authors. I speak to Dr. Nechama Brody about her new book, Femicide in South Africa, and Mervin speaks to Sifiso Mzobe about his new short story collection, Searching for Simpiwe. Then we hear from Book Lounge staff what they've been reading. Just a quick warning, today's episode contains a discussion about gender-based violence, so if you think you might find this hard to listen to, skip ahead 20 minutes. Welcome to A Reader's Community, a podcast brought to you by the Book Lounge.
It is with the heaviest of hearts that I stand before the women and the girls of South Africa this evening to talk about another pandemic that is raging in our country. The killing of women and children by the men of our country.
You'll recognize the voice of Cyril Ramaphosa, the South African president, talking about gender-based violence in his speech on the 17th of June, 2020. Last month, prompted by a few particularly horrific murders of young women, South Africans once again protested against the widespread violence against women in this country. Our first guest today is Dr. Nechama Brody, who has spent the last 7 years researching femicide, and she has turned that research into a remarkable book. The past month has made this book especially topical, but in fact, despite the recent attention gender-based violence has received, it is not a new crisis. It has been with us for a long time. I'm sure many of you, like me, have experienced outrage and felt the need for a resource, a strategy to move beyond outrage. This book is that. It shows the shape that gender-based violence takes in this country, ranging from intimate partner violence to witch killings to the targeting of elderly women. It shows how we can talk about this differently and advocate around it differently, and what policy changes might actually make a difference. Nechama agreed to come onto the podcast and have a conversation with me about her new book, Femicide in South Africa.
My name is Nechama Brody. I am a journalist, a writer, a new academic, and I suppose I mix up a lot of different careers and professions. Currently, I'm interested in writing about and researching violence, and I teach journalists about the work that I've been involved in for the last 25 years, which is mostly print media in South Africa, but also online and television. I'm what you call an old hack, I think, is the technical term for it. And I write books.
Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast, Nechama. You released two books this year, right?
I did.
It's not just Femicide in South Africa, but also Three Bodies.
Yeah, that's right.
And both of them were released during lockdown.
I know. It's really bizarre because also everybody's been saying, oh, it's amazing, you put out two books. What an incredible work ethic. And I was like, no, actually, I worked really hard last year. And so that in theory, I could reap the rewards of this hard work this year, except this year is such a mess that it feels like everything's kind of being thrown out into this giant space vacuum or matrix, and nobody knows where anything is going to land and where anything is going to fall. Yeah, I mean, Three Bodies literally arrived in bookstores just as lockdown started.
Just when no one could buy the book.
Yeah, it was a very strange experience.
So the book we're discussing today is Femicide in South Africa.
Yeah.
I'd like to go way back to the origin story of this book. So you started this as a PhD thesis in journalism.
Yeah.
What drew you to this topic?
7 years ago, almost exactly, I at one point used to work with Africa Check as a researcher and then later as a trainer. And one of the first big reports I did for Africa Check was in 2013 about claims that were being made around allegations of a white genocide that was supposedly happening in South Africa. And Steve Hofmeyr was one of the people who was very prominently behind those claims. And so I just did a report for Africa Check. Spent quite a long time researching it. We published it and we dismissed the claims. We went through them kind of number by number and said, this is not proven and there's no data here. So if you go and Google Africa Check and Steve Hofmeyr, you can find the report. And I did an interview with a journalist colleague, I think for Report. And one of the questions they asked me was, why is it a problem when people spread myths around violent crime, like this myth of white genocide? And my response was, you know, the problem with things like that is it gives us a kind of a false perception of who's at risk. And I said, you know, a white woman is far more at risk from her intimate partner than she is from a black stranger. And it was based on the research that I'd read at the time. I hadn't done my own studies yet. And I didn't think that much of it. But based on that comment, I got charged with hate speech at the Human Rights Commission.
Yeah.
Steve Hofmeyr and Sanette Bridges, Bless Bridges' daughter, and the Freedom Front and a couple of other people charged me and another researcher who came to my defense, Lisa Vetten, and the Medical Research Council and Africa Check with hate speech against white men for saying that white men killed their partners. And it was so interesting. And the charges, eventually the Human Rights Commission dismissed it. And I thought about it and I was trying to understand, why did people continue to believe in all these myths around crime? Why did they believe that white genocide was happening? Why did they believe that white women were not at risk from their intimate partners? Mm. And the one thing I thought of, I mean, I've worked as a journalist for a long time, was, what are they reading in the press? Where are they learning about this?
Mm.
And I tried to find out if there was any research about what the media covered in terms of femicide. In fact, there's a little bit of an extra part of this. Sunette Bridges, before the Human Rights Commission, started posting on Facebook lists of white women that had been murdered by black men. And she challenged me. She said, in Afrikaans, she said, I challenge Brody. She never contacted me directly. I challenge Brody to find 56 whatever white women who've been murdered by their partners. And at the time I was like, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to talk to her publicly, but I'll totally do this because I'm very good with media. I know how to find things.
Mm.
So I started looking through news reports and I couldn't find these stories of white women who were being killed by their partners.
Mm.
And I knew that they existed statistically because I'd read these Medical Research Council studies. And I was like, well, if these women are being killed by their partners, but they're not being covered in media, what's going on?
Yeah.
And the only way for me to really understand that was to build a very big database that actually looked at how the media covered femicide.
Mm.
And from that, then I could see what was covered. And by comparing that to other criminal data, I could try and guess at what wasn't.
Mm.
And what emerged was a very interesting picture. So first of all, intimate femicide is very underreported in the media. It should make up 50 to 60% of all femicides, but it only makes up about a third of media coverage. In addition, what I also found in my research was, if you only read Afrikaans language newspapers,
mm.
almost all of the victims you would read about would be white. Although white women make up a much smaller percentage of actual femicide victims, so less than 17%. But if you read Volksblad or Beeld or Rapport, Die Burger, between like 50 and 80% of the femicides that you would read about would be white women.
Yeah.
So if you were reading these newspapers only, you probably might feel like there was a white genocide.
Yeah.
So the way the media covers violence is exceptionally important.
Yeah.
So then after that, I decided that this would be a very good research topic. And then I spent the next 7 years building data around media coverage of femicide.
Sure. So what does this term femicide mean, and how is it different from men killing other men?
Femicide is an interesting term. It has a recent origin in terms of its application for study and research, but mostly kind of sociological study, where about 40 something years ago during the 1970s, there was an increase in feminist thought around the place of women in society and women in the home. So in the late 1970s, Diana Russell, who's actually a South African, presented a paper at a conference in Brussels and introduced the term femicide to talk about when a woman was killed because she was a woman.
Mm.
At that time, it was really a political statement. It was trying to understand the role of gender in terms of how women experienced and could experience society and what limited them. And it went through a whole bunch of iterations after that time. And Russell eventually kind of evolved her definition of femicide to be a woman who was killed by a man because she was a woman. Now, from a sociological theory point of view, that's fine. But when you actually start looking at crime in its reality, it's not a very practical definition. And people who study violent crime, particularly in the global south, where there are high levels of violent crime, and also low levels of policing often, have started to adapt the definition. And in South Africa, we're experts in violent crime because we have so much of it. But we've done a series of studies into the murder of women. And these femicide studies were conducted by the South African Medical Research Council, the first looking at data from 1999, the second looking at data from 2009. And the Medical Research Council studies used a particular definition of femicide, where they defined the femicide as being the homicide of any female aged 14 years or older. Now, the age delineation was important, but they didn't discriminate in terms of motive. Whereas the original definition of femicide that was put forward by Russell, it said that there had to be a motive. She had to have been killed because she was a woman. So gender-based violence like dowry murders or deaths as a result of female mutilation, women being killed because they're witches or suspected of being witches, these were considered to have a gender motive in the killing. The problem, though, is in a country like South Africa, where in a quarter or more of cases, you don't even know who the perpetrator was. So from my perspective as a researcher looking at violent crime in particular, needing to have motive as a definition is not useful in this circumstance. Because what we do see, though, is the ways that women are killed is different to the ways that men are killed. Anytime a man uses violence against you in society, it is almost always because you're a woman, but you can't always separate out that sort of misogyny from the motive. So that's one aspect of it. The second aspect, which is important from the Medical Research Council's studies, they included the homicides of all females aged 14 years and older. Because once women hit 14, whether or not they choose to, they engage in society in a way that exposes them to potential romantic relationships. And we see that epidemiologically in terms of how females are killed. There's a difference as to how infant or younger females or female children are killed as opposed to how adult females are killed. And the primary determining factor there is once a woman turns 14, she may become involved in romantic relationships, which is immediately a risk factor for violence. Or other men may wish her to become involved in relationships, whether or not she agrees to them or not. And so there's a term called intimate femicide, which describes a female who's murdered by her intimate partner, but that also includes people who have been rejected as intimate partners, as well as previous intimate partners. So we understand that there is a very specific dynamic that involves or that revolves around the idea of relationships, sort of adult or sexual or potentially sexual relationships between men and women. So the 14 years of age is kind of a cutoff, which means that it's not a guarantee, but we know that younger than that, girls are not usually involved in relationships. And after that, their epidemiological risk profile tends to become the same as that of an 18-year-old woman or a 25-year-old woman.
Wow. One thing that stood out was the lack of agency or lack of responsibility attributed to male assailants in the way in which it's reported. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about that.
There's an Australian journalist who has done a whole series on correcting news headlines. So she's kind of systematically gone through and corrected these news headlines that create this invisible perpetrator. So what this book uses to tell the story of femicide is looking back at media stories from the 1970s up until now to try and see what were the words that we used to describe these different acts. And, you know, has femicide itself changed or has just, or have the words that we use changed? And if you look back, I would read stories from the 1970s, which would write about a terrible family murder. And it would say, you know, this tragic event happened and a mother was found shot dead on the lawn and her baby and her husband were lying next to her dead on the lawn. And it sounds like this terrible massacre. And sort of two, three lines in, it tells you that, in fact, the person who had pulled the trigger was the father who was lying dead with them on the lawn. And it's such a interesting way of not blaming the person. And in fact, similar tactics are used by the media when they write about police brutality, particularly against black victims. It's almost like nobody knelt on somebody's throat to kill them. There was an invisible presence.
Yeah.
And this death just happened. We don't know why, you know, like there was no human agency involved in it. So it's something that, particularly from a journalism perspective, we need to start thinking about the ways in which we write about how, you know, people experience violence.
Yeah, I saw the blurb on the front of your book is from Sisonke Msimang, who I'm a big fan of.
Me too.
She says, Brody reminds us that how we write about women's deaths is often a reflection of how we think about women when they're alive. And writing about women's deaths is an issue of women's dignity. It's not a trivial matter.
Yeah. The UK has a project called Dignity for Dead Women, where they issue guidelines on how to cover domestic violence, in particular in the media. What you'll often see is a headline like, cheating wife, dies.
Yeah.
Right? So now it's her fault because she ended her marriage, or because she had a love affair with somebody outside of, she had an extramarital affair, or because she left her boyfriend 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, there is no justification for killing somebody because they hurt you, or even because they were rude to you, or they broke your heart. None of those are reasons to kill a person. But the press often entertains them as kind of the drama of this human engagement. And obviously it's quite titillating details sell more newspapers. So they like to play them up in headlines. But that completely erases any dignity for the victim.
I just loved reading your book, that the last few pages you gave some room for your rage in response to all of this horrible information. I really enjoyed it and I felt it was necessary. It was cathartic to read.
Okay.
But especially that idea of men who are not murderers and men who are not abusers who still act as a lookout for the patriarchy.
If you are not actively stopping violence against women, if you are not actively challenging it, you are enabling it. And I've had so many discussions with my partners, with my male friends, where they have easily agreed that in their own lives, on a number of occasions, they looked the other way.
Yeah.
Or simply didn't challenge somebody when a man made misogynistic comments or treated a woman inappropriately. It's an important concept. I think men who are willing to go there will easily get their heads around it. But I don't know if that in itself is enough to change or challenge where we are at as a society. So if you go back to the start of the book, where it talks about this definition of femicide, the reason why men don't see the problem in terms of all men enabling the expected submission or the actual domination, the physical domination of all women, is because it's written in our law books. It's inherently part of our society. So like the oldest law book that we have written down, which is, I don't know, 4,000 years old or 2,000 years old. Okay, I'm going to get the thousands of years. It's old. It predates the Hebrew Bible in terms of its writing. Yeah. It says, like, you know, law number two is if your wife cheats on you, you can kill her.
Mm.
So our very oldest legal systems in almost every single society on this planet have told men from the very beginning that females are property and that you are entitled to kill women under certain circumstances.
Yeah, and the laws were only written out of our current law books extremely recently, like in the last 100 years, instead of not in the last 500, you know?
Well, not even in the last 100. So the South African laws that recognizes rape within marriage was only changed in the 1990s.
Yeah.
And in other countries, even more recently than that.
Yeah.
So if you read through the legal arguments at the time, there was this great concern that if the state recognized rape within marriage, it would cause divorce. Because, you know, it was really important that after a man rapes his wife, that they're able to reconcile. And that was what consumed people more than anything else, was that this sanctimony of marriage should exist above and beyond all other things. This is 25 years ago.
Yeah, it's very recent.
When the majority of the living population on the planet has grown up with laws that tell them that. And their parents grew up with laws that also told them that. It's really hard for people to break away from an incredibly patriarchal system and say, okay, wait, no, I see there's a problem. Because it's not even, it's just the default. That's normal. It's not a glitch in the system. It is the system.
Yeah. I thought it was a very important book. I feel more equipped now myself to analyze media around femicide. Thank you so much. That was great. I really appreciate you doing this.
No, thank you for having me. And I do hope that the book becomes a resource that allows men and women to read beyond their own experience of violence and to understand how this type of violence affects women across South Africa in different ways.
Mm.
We maybe solve one symptom in one small area. Maybe not. But if we're going to make this better, we have to work together.
Yeah.
And that means we have to understand a much bigger picture.
Femicide in South Africa is available at the Book Lounge. Also check out Nechama's new crime novel called Three Bodies, also available at the Book Lounge. You may recall that in the first episode, Mervyn recommended Sifiso Mzobe's new collection of short stories, Searching for Simpiwe.
I've also read it since and loved it, so we decided we needed to get him onto the podcast. Mervyn got on a call with Sifiso.
Hi, this is Mervyn at the Book Lounge. I'm absolutely thrilled to be talking to Sifiso Mzobe today for our podcast to talk predominantly about his new collection of short stories, Searching for Simpiwe, which I absolutely loved. The stories in Searching for Simpiwe are all set in or around Mlazi and KZN. They feature memorable characters, working-class people who are so underrepresented in South African literature. Many of the stories center on crime, but the detectives that are central to Sifiso's stories tell us a different story to the popular narrative of an inefficient, often corrupt SAPS that takes up so much of the space in our media around policing. But it is Sifiso's skill as a storyteller that asks the reader, if you were in that situation, would you choose to be any different? I would much rather be talking to Sifiso in the same room in front of a big crowd of people, of fans itching to get their book signed, but that's not the world we're living in at the moment. So next best thing is to chat with me in Cape Town and him. He's going to tell you where he is in a sec. Sifiso, if you can just introduce yourself briefly.
Hi, I'm Sifiso Mzobe. I'm the author of Young Blood, a novel, and this collection of short stories called Searching for Simpiwe. Currently, I'm in Umlazi, a township outside of Durban, where it's sunny, unlike the terrible weather that you guys are getting there in Cape Town. So it's sunny, but a bit chilly. And of course, we're keeping our social distancing, staying home. Yeah, man.
Thanks, Sifiso. So, for people who don't know, Sifiso's novel Young Blood was published in, I think it was about 2010. It won the Sunday Times Literary Award, very deservedly, as well as the Wole Soyinka Prize for Literature in Africa and a bunch of other accolades. So I want to start off with a sort of a double congratulations. And the first is a slightly belated congratulations on the publication of Searching for Simpiwe. And the other is the relatively hot off the press news that Youngblood has been picked up by an overseas publisher, Catalyst Press. So congratulations on that. Tell us a little bit about that process.
Thank you very much, Mervyn. The process has been a long time in the making. The owner of the publishing company had read the book a couple of years ago. And, when she got the chance to publish it, she actually reached out to me on Facebook, believe it or not.
Wow.
And then she called me and she was doing some other business here in South Africa. And she came down to here to Durban. We had a meeting by the beachfront. We talked a bit about books and everything. And she was just so passionate about the story. And she showed a deep understanding of the book. And then as things go in the publishing world, things were quiet for quite a while after that. And then suddenly, within 2 weeks, I think, everything was done and everything was successful on that front.
Well, that's fantastic. I was so glad to hear the news. I think it's well-deserved. I think Youngblood is a fantastic novel, and it's so cool just to hear that it's going to be published in other parts of the world as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We spoke to Remy Ngomije on the previous edition of the podcast, and his book is also about to be published. Eternal Audience of One is about to be published overseas, and he has had to, or is still busy with, kind of quite a big editing process. And it sounds like it's going to be a very different edition of the book that hits the American market. In his case, with Youngblood, are they publishing it pretty much as it was published here, or have they asked you to make any changes?
No, I haven't been asked to make any changes, Mervyn. And we're busy doing the book cover now. I think maybe there'll be just a minor cosmetic changes to it, if any. But I haven't been asked to make any changes to it.
So tell me, Searching for Simpiwe, a wonderful collection of short stories that I absolutely loved. Some of them sort of feature common characters, so it feels like you're part of something bigger and people that you return to during the collection. I know that a couple of the stories have been published previously, sort of as individual kind of standalones. Have you been working on this collection for quite a long time?
Oh yes, some of the stories date back to 2013. I think the very first ones I wrote were in 2013, and I've been writing over the years. Mm. I just wanted to experiment. You know, with short stories, you can experiment. So I wanted to experiment, like, writing a female character, because, like, the detective in most of the stories is a female character. You know, I mean, I'm trying to learn as I go along as well. You learn until you write your last sentence before you fall and die, you know. So I try to keep learning. I try to experiment with the form as well in some of them.
What draws you to the form of a short story as opposed to writing a full-length novel?
I just like it, you know. I like the constraints that you don't have so many pages. I like finishing as well. Because a short story, you can finish.
Yeah.
And I like how it helps you to edit as well, Mervin. Because, you know, when you're writing, you like to keep everything because you think every sentence you write is the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
But when you have this, this constraints of these many words, you learn to write, you know, it's like you learn to go straight into the story in a simpler form.
Mm.
So that's what I like about short stories.
Yeah, and you certainly do that. I mean, any one of the stories in the book, you pick it up, you start reading, you feel as a reader, like you're just thrown into this, into the situation, into the lives of the characters. And I think characters is one of your many strong points as a writer. You mentioned just now the thing about writing from the perspective of female police officers, and Zandile and Gloria, Zandile in particular, is a sort of common thread through a lot of the stories. Talk a little bit more, firstly, about why you chose to have the main character in a lot of the stories as female. And then I was also wondering, because I feel like I've, you know, having read the entire collection, I feel like I've read quite a lot about Zandile. I would really like a full-length novel in which she's the centerpiece. Is there any likelihood of that? And then also, again, yeah, as I said, why you chose to write female characters as your central characters?
I think it just happened, Mervin, that I decided to write about Zandile. And I thought it would be interesting to get that view. I did quite a bit of research, and I have quite a lot of friends who are police officers. So I just found it interesting. And of course, I tried to put it in the book as well, because I thought this would be interesting to have her as a head of a household and to have added to this all the stresses of her job. In terms of the of a novel with her as a main character, never say never, you know. I think in future, yes, I would love to write a full-length novel with her as the main character. I think I can get a lot of things across in that.
Thanks so much, Sofiso, for joining us today for the podcast and for battling through the problems of internet connection, which has been difficult. We really, really appreciate your time and your willingness to participate in this.
Thank you very much, Mervin.
We've been talking about Sofiso's new collection of short stories, Searching for Simpiwe. It is available at the Book Lounge. And for those of you who missed out on his wonderful first novel, Youngblood, which, as we mentioned, is now being published overseas, that is still available, also from the Book Lounge. If you'd like either, drop us a mail and we'll sort that out for you.
Coming up, recommendations from Book Lounge staff. Vadner recommends a classic science fiction novel.
Hi, my name is Vadner. I work at the Book Lounge. As we were getting ready to record this, I realized that I have quite an eccentric reading pattern. The book we're talking about that I recommend is called The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick.
And what is it about?
Well, it's a science fiction novel written originally in 1965. And it's this dystopian idea that the Axis powers end up winning the Second World War. So it's set in this sort of alternate world where the Third Reich is in power, and the story is set in America where Japan is now the ruling power. So it's this interesting twist on reality where the Cold War, for instance, is now between Japan and Germany.
That's fascinating.
It is, and in the book, The Man in the High Castle, it has this novel that a lot of the characters are reading, which is called The Grasshopper Lies Heavy. And in this novel that people are reading in the book is about what if America had won the war. and this thing is banned by the Third Reich. Like, you can't, you're not allowed to read this book. So it kind of does that self-referential thing. And what's interesting about it is that although it's got these sort of overt ways that the sci-fi universe building usually happens, but in a lot of subtle ways, it's sort of pointing fingers at how different our world is now, and that the things that we take for granted, and how easily these things could have been different.
Yeah,
it's a really good read. It's very well written, and it's surprisingly relevant to the times we live in.
Let's hear Norma's recommendation.
My name is Norma, and I like to read books about feminism and mental health.
And what book are you recommending this week?
I am recommending Hood Feminism by Mikki Kendall.
Can you tell us about it?
So it's an interesting book, right? When I came into feminism, I thought that, oh, you know, it's just women together.
Yeah.
And then I learned about intersections and how Black women feel left behind by white feminists. And I thought this is actually interesting to get into it and to read about it. It talks about different types of things like eating disorders and how eating disorders are glamorized to be just for white girls, but that Black people also have eating disorders just in different ways, which I think is very interesting because it also links to like Black people's mental health and how it's portrayed in social media.
So what advice does she give to feminists?
She calls us out, like, we shouldn't be social media feminists. So the question is, what are you actually doing to help the movement? What are you doing to help those who are left behind? I think also men who want to know about feminism should read this book.
Oh, interesting.
It's very accessible. She doesn't use hard language. She even said herself that feminism is more about lived experience than it is about complicated theory. And that at the end of the day, that theory doesn't really matter if you're gonna ignore real life lived experience.
Finally, we hear from Megan what she's been reading.
Hi, I'm Megan. I'm one of the fiction buyers at the Book Lounge, and I love being told a good story. I don't think there's anything like it in the world.
What have you been reading, Megan?
So I just finished reading Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell. Hamnet is the story of Shakespeare's son, on whom or for whom the play Hamlet was written. It is the story of the loss of a child. And as a mother, I find those stories very difficult, but it's dealt with such incredible beauty. The story of both the mother and the father, of how they meet, also the picture it paints of society at the time, is absolutely brilliant.
So it's not really about like Shakespeare as a literary giant.
Do you know, it's funny you should ask, because as I read it, I kept thinking it doesn't really matter that it's Shakespeare, except that the importance of the fact that he is a playwright builds towards the end of the book, and I can't tell you why. Not that there's anything to give away as such, but there is a catharsis almost related to that. But the fact that he's William Shakespeare isn't really here or there. It's the story of a family at a certain point in time and of the emotions they go through during, before, during, and after this horrendously tragic event. It's something that I would recommend almost universally because it is just a really gorgeous story, really well told.
That's our show. A Reader's Community is brought to you by The Book Lounge, an independent bookstore in Cape Town. You can support The Book Lounge by ordering books to be delivered to your home. If you would like to send in a request for a personalized book recommendation, WhatsApp us a voice message telling us what you're in the mood to read and two books you loved recently. You can find the number in the description. You're also welcome to email us any feedback or comments. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is booklounge@gmail.com. You can find all the titles mentioned in the episode in the description. Thanks to Dr. Nechama Brody and Sufiso Mzorbe for being on this episode. Our producer is Andy Burnett. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Fasti Karlitz, and we will be with you again in 2 weeks. Until then, keep reading.